Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The Republican Party's long effort to repeal and maybe replace Obamacare lived to fight another day yesterday. Despite deep divisions, the GOP rallied in the Senate with the help of a tie-breaking vote by Vice President Mike Pence. John McCain out of the hospital on the Senate floor to vote. But if you think you know where this political fight is headed, think again. This hour on Point, the GOP's revived health care push. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you think the GOP efforts were dead? Do you think they now have a chance to get it together? And did you cheer or moan when the vice president breathed new life into the GOP push yesterday? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. All kinds of tension in the Senate chamber yesterday as this proceeded rapidly toward ahead. Protesters interrupted the vote at one point on the motion to proceed with debate on a Republican health care bill sight unseen. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was cut off as he asked for the yeas and nays. Kill the bill. Don't kill us. Kill the bill, they said.
Ask for the yeas and nays.
Kill the bill.
Ask for the yeas and nays.
Deep divisions in the GOP. It stymied the efforts to repeal and replace in the end two Republicans, Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, voted against the motion. It fell to Vice President Mike Pence to cast the tie-breaking vote, and the tally was called.
On this vote, the yeas are 50 and the nays are 50. The Senate being equally divided, the Vice President votes in the affirmative, and the motion is agreed to.
And Mitch McConnell saying he wants something and he wants it fast. He wants to finish by the end of this week and then get together with the House and see what they can work out.
It's an open amendment process. This is just the beginning. We're not out here to spike the football. This is a long way. But we'll finish at the end of the week, hopefully, with a measure that can either go to the House and be taken up or go to conference.
So where are we here? Later in this hour, the New York Times wants an apology from Fox News. We'll dig into that. But first, healthcare. Joining us from Washington is Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome back as always. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And Noam Levy is with us from Washington, national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Wow, where to begin? Noam, what are the chances of something coming out of this that will at least take down the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, repeal some part of it?
I think it's important to say that nobody knows for sure. It does. We have a little bit of a wild card in here, which was introduced yesterday. Recall that for months we've been talking about either repealing most of Obamacare and replacing it later, or repealing large parts of it, replacing it with something else. Yesterday, we learned that Senate Majority Leader McConnell and other GOP leaders are discussing something much more limited.
A skinny repeal, it's been called.
A skinny repeal, as it's called, that's right, which would repeal just the most unpopular parts of the Affordable Care Act, the mandates that require Americans to have health insurance and require employers to have health coverage. It would also get rid of one of the taxes. So those have always been, as I said, sort of the flashpoints in the Affordable Care Act. There are some policy issues which we can go into that make that challenging as well. But we may emerge at the end of this with either nothing or something that is considerably more limited, I think, than most Republicans and most of the country believed when this process got started.
Lisa Desjardins, though, what's the possibility here for a kind of end run around the opposition that this has run into in the Senate? If Mitch McConnell can push through a skinny repeal, just eliminating medical device taxes established by Obamacare, as Noam reports, eliminating the mandates requiring Americans to have coverage and requiring large employers to offer health benefits, if he pushes a skinny repeal through, do they then get into conference committee with the House? And could they then sort of recreate whatever form they want here, even something that senators might not have agreed to on the Senate floor, Lisa?
Absolutely. Once they get to conference committee, the entire bill can change yet again. But you have to keep in mind, they're still going to need 50 votes in the U.S. Senate for whatever comes out of conference committee. So what happens this week will have a major role in what comes out of conference committee, because they are testing all these different ideas to see how much support they have in the Senate. For example, last night, a version of the original Senate bill that included that amendment from Ted Cruz that would allow insurers to have kind of bare bones plans without a lot of Obama regulations, and including some regulations about essential benefits, a version of that plan failed in a fiery way. It lost 9 Republicans. It wasn't even close. So they have a real problem, and part of this week is about moving forward in the process. Another part is figuring out what can pass in the end in both the House and the Senate.
Can you see something changing? No, I'm in the dynamic here. If a skinny repeal gets through, they get to conference committee, they work something out, they bring it back to the Senate at that point. Does it change any minds that it's been through the conference, sausage maker? Does that change Susan Collins' mind, change Lisa Murkowski's mind?
Well, it may not change their minds, but their minds are probably less important than the minds of a half dozen other senators who have voiced substantial reservations about the repeal push thus far. But when push came to shove yesterday and the Senate had to vote to bring up this debate, all of them fell in line behind Leader McConnell and President Trump. So the question, I think, really is if it goes to conference, and I think there is an open question about whether it goes to conference, right, or whether a skinny bill just gets taken up by the House. If it does go to conference and comes back to the Senate for another vote, the question is, will people like Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican senator from West Virginia, mm-hmm, Rob Portman from Ohio, Dean Heller from Nevada, these senators whose states have benefited quite substantially from the Affordable Care Act, will these senators get on board with something that's substantially more robust than a skinny repeal, but perhaps stops short of the bill that many of them voted against last night?
Lisa, can you describe the pressures and/or inducements being brought to bear on Capito, Heller, Portman, Collins, Murkowski? I mean, we've heard the president saying loud and clear it's sad that the people that haven't supported this and their futures don't look good if they don't support this. What is the pincer of, I don't know, threat and inducement that's being brought to bear on these senators, Lisa?
I think you can't overstate the pressure on these members that Noam's talking about, the ones who will end up deciding the fate of healthcare probably for the rest of America, including Shelley Moore Capito. And I think the important part here, Tom, is it's monumental pressure from two sides, political pressure from the Republican Party, from their leader in the Senate, from the president himself. Personally, I know in the lunch last week, he personally singled out Shelley Moore Capito during a lunch with all of the Republican senators. That's just one plate of pressure on them. On the other side, they have constituents and they have groups, including major medical groups, the AMA, also groups like the AARP, who are telling them that this bill is a disaster. And that includes millions of their own constituents who are very scared personally. Their phones are ringing off the hook. They are getting tremendous pressure against the bill, even as they get pressure politically for it.
I mean, the pressures from all sides. Noam, you report, remind us of those lined up against Republican plans, the American Diabetes Association, the March of Dimes, the AARP, the American Medical Association, the American Lung Association, the Multiple Sclerosis Society, American Heart Association, American Cancer Society's advocacy arm. I mean, it looks like everybody out there. We've got a lot of listeners who really wonder what's going on here with questions for the two of you. Jill in Franconia, New Hampshire. Jill, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Tom. So yesterday Trump tweeted, "We can now deliver great health care to all Americans." And what is he talking about? I mean, has he even glanced at what his own party has put forward or the CBO numbers? This notion that there's going to be great health care to all Americans, that's crazy. And then the Republicans, I don't understand what they're doing. They have yet to come up with anything that can get even 20% approval from the American people. And I don't see how this isn't political suicide. I mean, it's clearly not about the American people, and I don't understand what it is about. Is it about the Koch brothers? You know, what is propelling the GOP to do this?
We will pick it straight up. Here was the president, and then I'll take it straight to our panel in a Rose Garden press conference yesterday, went after the two senators who voted against the motion to proceed.
So we had two Republicans that went against us, which is very sad, I think. It's very, very sad for them. But I'm very, very happy with the result. I believe now we will, over the next week or two, come up with a plan that's going to be really, really wonderful for the American people.
Really, really wonderful. Our caller doesn't buy it, Noam, and wonders what really is driving this. You've been covering this for months, years now. At bottom, what is driving this relentless, will not surrender, never say die attitude in the Republican leadership?
Well, you know, repealing Obamacare has been an organizing political principle for the Republican Party for 7 years. Since this law was enacted in March of 2010, the party has characterized the Affordable Care Act as, without hyperbole, calling it the worst piece of legislation that has ever passed.
I mean, that's hyperbole, but you're not exaggerating. That's exactly what they say.
That is what they have said. And so there is a base of the Republican Party that has been demanding this for 7 years, and Republicans go against that at their peril. When they go home to deeply red states or deeply red congressional districts, they know that while the majority of the public doesn't support what they're doing, while every major patient group, every major physician group, every major hospital group, every major nurses association, every major healthcare group in the United States says, stop, we should do this differently. If you look at the polling, Republican voters overwhelmingly still want to repeal Obamacare.
Is it political suicide, Lisa? Jill in New Hampshire asks.
You know, that's the fear for Republicans, is that no matter what they do at this point, that they may suffer consequences. And that's especially a fear for moderates, because they are the ones who tend to lose their seats, both in the House and the Senate, in moments like this, regardless of how they vote, because of people being unsatisfied. As to what the GOP is doing, I think Noam covered it well, but I would add one other thing. They feel like this is their one chance to reform Medicaid. They added a huge Medicaid reform and cut to this bill that may have doomed it from the start.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Before we get back to the show, I wanted to tell you to be sure and stay with us till the very end of this podcast for a preview of Freak Out and Carry On. It's WBUR's new podcast that addresses today's politics through a historical lens. Give it a listen. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Republicans' revived health care push with 51 votes to debate a bill that no one had exactly seen. The scramble is back on in the Senate. Noam Levy is with us from the Los Angeles Times. He's been covering all of this. You can read his latest reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Link to it there. Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, is with us from Washington. She has been in the thick of this. You can join us as well. What's your response to what we saw last night? Could this week bring us a new healthcare reality in a blind rush? And what do you think of John McCain's role yesterday out of the hospital onto the Senate floor with an important vote in the vote to proceed to the debate? That won with a one-vote majority, that vote from Vice President Mike Pence. Then Mitch McConnell brought his big plan to the floor, and immediately his Republicans, Democrats are sitting on their hands here, but Republicans not going for it. Here was the vote. It went down 57-43.
On this vote, the yeas are 43, the nays are 57. Three-fifths of the senators duly chosen and sworn not having voted in the affirmative, the motion is not agreed to.
After the vote to proceed with debate, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer rose and warned the GOP's continuing efforts will mean trouble for American health care.
The proposal Leader McConnell made is nothing more than a ruse. Anyone who voted to move to proceed And certainly anyone who votes to send this bill to conference is virtually certainly voting to kick millions off health care, to make it much harder to get coverage if you have a pre-existing condition, to slash Medicaid, and to give a huge amount of tax cuts to the rich.
And then the John McCain story. Noam, Lisa, I want to ask you about this. He came out of the Mayo Clinic. They'd gone in and found brain cancer during surgery there. And there he was on the Senate floor, big scar over his eyebrow, and saying, look, he wouldn't vote for the bill as it is today. Would not do it. But he did vote to let the whole thing move ahead. Here was McCain.
I will not vote for this bill as it is today. It's a shell of a bill right now. We all know that. I have changes urged by my state's governor that will have to be included to earn my support for final passage of any bill.
Lisa, what do you make of John McCain's role here yesterday?
You know, I think it wasn't a surprise that he voted yes for to open debate. But I think the truth of it is that I don't think his message will make a difference this week. I think that the Republican leadership is locked into their game plan for health care for right now. If they cannot get a bill out of the Senate this week, then we will see John McCain's words perhaps take effect. They will fall back to a larger committee process. I think everyone in the Senate agreed with what he said, but the leadership is not, on both sides, is not willing to change how they operate right now.
Wow. Within days, is it realistic to you, Noam, that Mitch McConnell will get a vote this week on something that could go to conference?
Oh, I think so. Most certainly. The skinny bill we were talking about earlier, maybe the last gasp that McConnell has, but as we were talking about, there is a huge amount of pressure on Republicans to get something, anything across the finish line and declare it, declare victory. If they don't do that, they have nothing to show, essentially, for 6 months of being in total control of Washington. So I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that something passes.
Lisa, what about the crowbars that could be brought to bear here with the senators who have resisted this? Crowbars are, again, inducements. Exactly where might they go in? What's the Murkowski vulnerability or openness, the Susan Collins? Have they made demands that the leadership can meet?
I think Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski are almost certain no votes at this point, depending on how the end bill looks. But Lisa Murkowski did share her thoughts with one organization, the Alaska Dispatch News, just published an account of why she voted no yesterday. And she said simply she felt that the debate's not ready, that this isn't cooked yet, and that there needs to be more time to really consider what they're doing. So that's not going to change this week. So she seems unlikely to get to yes. But as far as crowbars, I think there's more carrots here. A lot of money potentially going to states that need it for, say, fighting the opioid crisis, also for helping states stabilize and deal with people who may lose Medicaid from any potential bill. I think look for the amount of dollars that are flowing and also watch conservatives. Those are folks who don't like big government spending. It'll be interesting to see how they go along with perhaps what might be large amounts of kind of unfocused government spending in a big bill.
Noam, where could they buy the votes in effect here? And what about conservative resistance to that?
Well, so again, to sort of stay on the skinny bill here for a second.
And again, this would just do away with the mandate to have coverage, with the requirement of large employers offering health benefits, and maybe this medical device tax.
That's right. I mean, the benefit of the skinny bill for more centrist Republicans, these Republicans who come from states that expanded Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act, that saw large gains in health coverage, Arizona, Ohio, West Virginia, Nevada. The advantage of that is that those programs stay in place. So those senators probably don't need additional inducements to get behind something like that. The question really becomes, will conservatives be satisfied with something that stops well short of rolling back the Affordable Care Act? And I think that's an open question. We've already seen a little bit of comment from House conservatives, from some Republican senators who have said they don't think something that only repeals the mandates and one of the taxes is going to be sufficient to live up to their promise. But if it's a take-it-or-leave-it proposition, you know, that tends to focus the mind of lawmakers.
If you're desperate to say, we did it, that's one way to do it. Liz in Akron, Ohio. Liz, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
My question or comment has to do with checks and balances. I understand that the president is putting people under a lot of pressure to, you know, repeal Obamacare. But the thing is that the president's not the one who put them in office. We are. And I know I'm not the only one who this is important to. I went home last night feeling devastated. I have a 10-year-old and I have an 8-year-old. My 10-year-old has digestive problems, and my 8-year-old has had lumps in her cheek that have been having to be monitored for the last year because they're hoping it's not cancer.
Yeah.
And the thing is that the ACA is the only reason that I've been able to get my kids the help that they need. If they take the ACA away, I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, my kids' medical care is in jeopardy, and I feel like this is the time that if we're really American, we have to put people before party, and people come first. And how do I go home at night and tell my kids, I can't take you to the doctor because our president doesn't want you to have medical care? This is just wrong. It's unethical. And I'm torn. I'm horribly torn up.
Liz, we hear it, and we wish you and everybody the best of luck here. Lisa, that's a powerful appeal right there. Does that not factor into Republican political calculation, which is, after all, in the end, about people and votes?
I think it factors in for these moderates who are having trouble with this bill. They're thinking about stories like that, and they're thinking about people on Medicaid. But I think Republicans are also thinking about, as Noam said earlier, they're thinking about their promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Those who feel so strongly believe that the message has just not gotten out, that things could be better without it. But, of course, people like Liz see the benefits in their life in a very real and important way. And that's really the problem here for Republicans. They said they wanted to repeal it, but now there are people who are realizing how valuable they believe it is in their lives.
Noam, is there a credible case that things would be better without it under what's been the range of solutions Republicans have offered?
So, Tom, I will tell you, I have traveled the country over the last 7 years talking to people about this law, visiting with physicians, visiting with hospitals, visiting with clinics. Mm. There are so many stories like Liz's out there of people whose lives, literally, I have interviewed people whose lives have literally been saved by having health insurance coverage. There is, I must say, a somewhat astonishing willingness on the part of some politicians to deny that reality. There's also now a growing body of evidence that suggests that having health insurance coverage, remember, this law has added 20 million more people to the rolls of the insured, that giving people health insurance not only gives them better access to medical care, allows them to get to the doctor, it actually leads to better health. And that body of scientific evidence has been dismissed and poo-pooed, I'm afraid to say, by one side on this political debate. Now, that being said, are there things that could be improved about the American healthcare system, about the Affordable Care Act? Unquestionably, yes. Has it worked as well as President Obama and others who wrote it claimed it would? No.
Are those improvements on the table?
Frankly, those improvements are not on the table. But there are a group of people out there who have not done particularly well under the Affordable Care Act, people who had health insurance before the ACA, who have seen premiums rise quite substantially. There's probably some things that could be done to address some of those shortcomings. But at the moment, not many of those things are on the table.
Emma in Lake Okoboji, Iowa. Emma, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I listened to John McCain's speech the other day after I got off of work, and I was really taken back by what he said, criticizing not only the Senate, but criticizing his own party on the actions that they're taking moving forward with trying to repeal the ACA. I believe in the ACA. I think that it is a really important step in improving the health care in America, as has been said multiple times in the show this today.
Okay.
And I am hopeful that Republicans will take into heart the things that John McCain said yesterday, coming out of the hospital to vote and deliver this speech and say, that we need to take a step back and we need to think of the American people as we move forward with this. And maybe I'm blindly optimistic. I don't trust my own senator to make that decision, But I'm hopeful that moving forward, people will keep John McCain's words in mind.
Emily, I appreciate your call. Noam, is there any evidence of a return to the kind of normal order, normal legislative order that John McCain appealed for yesterday, of that coming?
In a word, no. And I think it's worth noting that notwithstanding the nobility of Senator McCain's remarks on the floor last night, they were undercut somewhat by the actions he took. If he had voted against, for example, the motion to proceed to this debate, he could have accomplished the very aim which he set out, which was to return this to regular order and set up a system by which healthcare legislation could be considered by committee. So I think, unfortunately, for the Senate, perhaps, unfortunately for our government institutions, this process probably is going to have to run its course before there can be any serious discussion about returning to a more rational legislative process.
It's a short course. If Mitch McConnell has his way, he wants a vote. He wants something out to end conference by this week. Denzel in Greenville, North Carolina. Denzel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First, I'd like to agree with your panelists about John McCain. His words were great. They brought everyone together, but he just got out of the hospital and he voted to take health care away from millions of people. I find that to be ridiculous. And Trump, he's just on a big propaganda spree with Obamacare about how it can't be revived, and he has the whole base eating out of his hand with everything he says. And I'd just like to speak and hear from his base about why they think it's okay to take health care from millions of people because your premiums went up, when it'll be a lot easier to fix that than to take health care away from millions and millions. I just don't understand it, Tom.
Lisa, you hear the exasperation in that voice. You also know there's a base out there that wants it gone.
Right.
Is there a bridge out there somewhere? Could this look so perilous to Republicans that is there any room for them to say, okay, Democrats, get in here, let's work something out, and we can persuade our base and the American people that in the end, we did the right thing by fixing something rather than just repealing?
Well, there are certainly a handful of Republican senators who would love to do that, and maybe even a majority of them who wouldn't mind talking with Democrats. But in public, no. There's not any path to that kind of conversation right now, except, as Noam observed, if this entire week's effort fails. You know, and that certainly remains to be seen. It does seem that they are on track to pass perhaps something, but as long as they are, then there's no room for this kind of bipartisan, maybe more moderate path to dealing with health care. And it's worth saying that this whole debate really only deals in part with the healthcare insurance system. It's not really dealing with the cost of healthcare necessarily, or the quality of healthcare, or how healthy Americans are. So this is a really small part of a much larger problem, and yet the Senate is still stymied.
The repeal and replace later option, Noam, that this Congressional Budget Office says would put $32 million maybe out of health insurance, is that a live option still or not?
Well, it'll come up for a debate this morning, but there isn't a whole lot of expectation that's going anywhere. Quite a number of Republican senators are uncomfortable with something that throws that many Americans out of coverage. So I don't think that's a way forward.
What do you think is going on right now in the chambers? I don't know, in Mitch McConnell's office, or you name it, Rob Portman's office, or Capito, Shelley Moore Capito. What is happening? We're at Wednesday. Mitch McConnell wants a vote this week. That means every hour matters here. What's going on?
Well, I can speak. I know for a lot of members are drafting amendments. They're getting ready for what will be an avalanche of amendments and what's called Votorama, a lot less fun than that name implies. They're just going to vote on dozens of amendments. There probably will be no debate on most of these amendments. They'll come up quickly. We will, as reporters, be scrambling to find out what's in them, even as the votes are happening, it looks like. And I think a lot, basically both sides are preparing for battle, and they're preparing for these amendment votes. The Democrats want to come up with as many difficult amendment votes as they can. Republicans, I think for the most part, are trying to change the bill, each of them in their own direction, some of them trying to find ways to get to that magical skinny bill. And so I think in their offices, everyone is quickly typing up potential amendments right now, making a lot of phone calls on those.
And what's the base vehicle that they're amending, Noam?
Well, from a technical standpoint, it's the bill that the House passed in May. But practically speaking, whatever the last amendment that Leader McConnell feels can get the 50 votes he needs, that will be the final bill. It'll be the final vote. It will wipe out whatever comes before it, which sort of goes again to the incredible nature of this process. Essentially, not only is this bill sort of being written on the fly, but it will be dropped presumably maybe minutes or hours before senators will vote on it. It will be the health care plan. It likely will have had no independent analysis of what its potential impact will be. It's quite astonishing.
Are senators going to know what they're voting on?
They may not know much about it.
Even as they cast the vote, it's kind of incredible, but that's where we are right now in a week that Mitch McConnell says he wants to culminate with action, with Senate action, conference committee, and then we're on to a whole new path. Wow, this has been some ride, and it continues to be. Noam Levy with the Los Angeles Times, in the thick of it as always, and we're very grateful for your reporting and for your sharing it with us today. Thank you, Noam. Thank you for being here.
Good to be with you.
Lisa Desjardins with the PBS NewsHour. Always good to have you right here, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for a great conversation.
When we come back, it's Fox News versus the New York Times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Fox News recently reported that the New York Times published information that cost the U.S. government the chance to kill the leader of ISIS. Trouble is, the information was first released by the Pentagon and reported by Fox itself well before the New York Times story. The Times demanded an apology. President Trump is in the mix. It's all part of ratcheted up pressure on news gatherers. We want to look at this dust up, maybe more than that, between the Times and Fox News. Joining me now via Skype from Washington is Hadass Gold. She covers media and politics for Politico. Hadass Gold, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you.
And with us from London is Angelo Carasone, president of the liberal media watchdog group Media Matters for America. Angelo, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Hadass, can you describe to us, remind us, what unfolded here that had the New York Times making this, I think, unprecedented request, demand for an apology from Fox News?
So this actually all started with General Tony Thomas, who was at this festival or this conference in Aspen, where he was being interviewed by a Fox News reporter, Catherine Herridge. And in that interview, he talked about how they had a very good lead to kill this ISIS leader, al-Baghdadi, but that, quote, unfortunately, it was leaked in a prominent national newspaper about a week later, and that lead went dead.
We're talking about events in 2015 here.
Right, events in 2015. Now, what happened was that the Pentagon had actually announced a raid that they announced had given them good information to potentially lead to the capture of this man. Fox News then later reported on those statements made by the general and said that it was the New York Times who had reported on the details that potentially could have harmed the attempt to get this ISIS leader. Now, the New York Times says that a lot of outlets report on this, that the Pentagon itself announced this raid. The New York Times did report further details, and others did, especially in a June article. But they say that it is completely untrue, that it was their fault. What happened, though, is that when Fox and Friends reported on this on Saturday morning, they had chyrons, which are those little title cards at the bottom of the screen that said New York Times foils attempt to get al-Baghdadi. Their hosts pretty much blamed the New York Times for this, and then
question the Times patriotism.
Yes, question the Times patriotism, and then the president tweeted about this. He said that the New York Times foiled this attempt, that they have their own agenda over national security, and that led to the New York Times requesting that Fox issue an apology.
Let's go back to the original tape. This was at the Aspen Security Forum last week, and we had General Tony Thomas. He's been right in the middle of Special Operations High Command for the U.S. military. And the general said there, and this also seemed to be misleading given the facts of the case, that the ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was near capture but got away because of a report in a major American paper. He didn't say which one. Fox and Friends laid that charge at the feet of the New York Times. Here was the general.
It was a very good lead. Unfortunately, it was leaked in a prominent national newspaper about a week later, and that lead went dead. So, that's the challenge we have in terms of where and how our tactics and procedures are discussed openly. There's a great need to inform the American public about what we're up to. There's also a great need to recognize things that will absolutely undercut our ability to do our job.
Now, it looks like the general was engaged in a little revisionist history there. It was much more than a week. It was several weeks after the Pentagon itself had announced this raid and the material that they had retrieved, and after Fox News had reported on this. But Fox picked right up on this. The general was being interviewed by one of their people in Aspen, and here's part of Fox and Friends, the Saturday show, accusing the New York Times of leaking highly sensitive information. This is Peter Hegseth.
He's sitting talking to our own Catherine Herridge, admitting that we would have had al-Baghdadi based on the intelligence we had, except someone leaked information to the failing New York Times in 2015. This is the previous administration. And as a result, we think he slipped away.
And then just piling on with the kind of language that we've heard a lot of from President Donald Trump. Here's Hegseth and his Abby Huntsman, his co-host there.
That's one of the other reasons it's the failing New York Times. It's not just failing in its credibility. It's failing our country.
Well, it's failing the American people because
war fighters.
Yeah, you think about what the role is of media today. Is it to inform and to protect the American people? Because if that is the case, you think about something like that and the harm that it does to our national security.
Angelo Carusone, I'm sure you've followed all this. What do you make of this fight between the Times and Fox News on this point?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of context, even beyond the broader attacks and relationship between Trump and the New York Times and the rest of the news media, in just this particular triangle from a few weeks ago, because it was just July 10th that Fox and Friends ran a report that claimed that James Comey had leaked top secret information to the New York Times and that it was illegal. Donald Trump proceeded to tweet about it, parroting exactly the New York Times, the Fox and Friends segment. Fox and Friends subsequently issued a correction the next day. Donald Trump did not correct it, nor did he, you know, take down any of his tweets. But it was sort of a very similar dynamic in which, one, it was totally fabricated. Two, the New York Fox and Friends just sort of jumped to the conclusion that it was the New York Times. So they were picking up sort of the Donald Trump's favorite target. And then three, they had it completely wrong, but it still made its way to Donald Trump's Twitter feed. So when you fast forward to the most recent events, the thing that I find interesting is that you're right. The Times never really came up. It was actually Fox and Friends that injected that into the narrative. And in part, I think it demonstrates the continuation of this broader sort of, you know, battle and war that Trump is waging through these sort of media proxies on venerable institutions. And it's not just the Times. It's obviously many other outlets as well. But the Times by far is the outlet that Donald Trump has attacked the most on his social media accounts since he's been president, over 20 times. And that's more than any other individual outlet or paper.
It was a major raid in 2015. The Pentagon was very quick to talk about it, crow about it. They shared that they scooped up a lot of information there about how the ISIS leader al-Baghdadi moved around. They had come up with the wife of one of his chief lieutenants there, and they made it clear that they had her in their custody. Fox News came out talking about this, and about a week after the Pentagon made its own revelations, and then the Times 3 weeks after, and then last week we come back to this general who's characterized or recharacterized what happened there. I mean, Hadass, that's interesting in itself. Does it appear that the Pentagon narrative or some portion of it has reworked these events to lay the failure to ultimately get Baghdadi at that time at the feet of the New York Times? Is that what the general's remarks indicate?
I mean, this is a really good point that a lot of these questions lay with General Thomas and what he exactly meant, who and what exactly he was specifically speaking to. The New York Times, in that June article where they did include more details, including they detailed things that they seized a trove of 4 to 7 terabytes of data about what was going on. So it is true that they reported a lot more details. The Times says that they cleared all of these details with the Pentagon before reporting them, and that the Pentagon had no objections to them reporting reporting any of this information because, as people should know, sometimes news organizations will purposely not report details that they might have if the government presents a compelling case that says that it could harm, put people in harm's way or could harm a very important operation. Then sometimes news organizations will show discretion and not report those. And in this case, they said the Pentagon did not object to anything and that they have not heard any complaints from any senior American official until General Thomas's comments. So clearly there's a lot more that we need to figure out here and just go to the general himself and see why he said the things that he did this past weekend.
Now, back at the time, Fox News had come out themselves well before the New York Times, a couple of weeks, and said on air that the newly recovered intelligence from this raid, this is quoting Fox here, may bring the U.S. closer to Baghdadi's kill or capture. So the gist of it was already right there. The Pentagon was already talking about it. But then Fox and Friends over the weekend casting it in this new way, the Times reporting foils capture of ISIS leader. And within 20-25 minutes of that Fox report on air, you have the President of the United States tweeting. This was Donald Trump on Saturday. The failing New York Times foiled U.S. attempt to kill the single most wanted terrorist, al-Baghdadi. Their sick agenda over national security. I mean, Angelo, the President comes in here and sort of puts the pedal to the metal and takes it right down to a Times-driven agenda. It's a threat to American national security. Just buys the Fox version or takes it and runs hard with it, Angelo.
Yeah, and that's what underlies all of this is that Fox and Friends it did not even do the most basic put aside of the fact check. They didn't even reach out to the target for a comment. Had they done that, there's a great likelihood that the segment would not have run in the way that it did, in which case it would not have poisoned the well or misinformed Donald Trump, and therefore not led to this cascade of tweets and sort of more fuel to the fire against some of these stalwart news media. And one thing that jumps out to me about all of this, and it sort of, I think, brings everything full circle and is somewhat ironic, is that Fox and Friends has long had a history of taking content both from FoxNews.com and from other sites and running it. And back in 2009, after they had run a series of pretty big flaps under very similar circumstances, John Moody, who was the vice president of news at the time at Fox News, actually did a very extensive interview with the New York Times, admonishing Fox and Friends, his own network's program, for failing to meet even the most basic journalistic standards when it came to verifying segments and content for segments that were running. And he issued a dictate to the newsroom that said that stories, even those that appear on Fox News, cannot just on FoxNews.com, cannot just be independently run as a segment during Fox and Friends unless they are verified. And so what I find interesting about all of this is that it's coming full circle, because when Fox was trying to sort of clean this long pattern up at Fox and Friends, they actually went to the Times to try to reestablish themselves. And here we are, where the Times has now been a recipient, not just once, but twice so far this month, of a misleading or completely false Fox and Friends segment that gets into Donald Trump's Twitter feed. And what this really does underscore is the symbiotic relationship between some of Fox News' programming, there's other right-wing media as well, but in particular Fox and Friends and Sean Hannity, and the lens through which Donald Trump's worldview is greatly informed. I mean, they really do shape the lens through which he sees the world. And I think that's ultimately what the takeaway is here.
Of course, the president really taking it another step forward with his their sick agenda over national security. I mean, this is the kind of characterization of press reporting that in many countries precedes a crackdown on the press. You say, well, the reporting is a threat to national security, and pretty soon, I don't know about this country, but in a lot of other countries, that's the prelude to really getting in to it with a free press that ends up, in other countries anyway, not so free. Kayla in Johnson City, Tennessee. Kayla, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have a comment about Donald Trump getting his news directly from Fox and Friends. Why would the president, someone who could get any information that he wanted as far as how the government works and what's going on in the United States, sit and watch Fox and Friends every day and then tweet about it and tweet what he thought about the show, pretty much repeat exactly what they had said right after the show is over? I mean, Donald Trump is pretty much like any regular old grandfather in the United States just sits and watches Fox and Friends and believes everything that he hears on it. And as far as the president goes, that's insane.
Let me take it to Hadass. Hadass, what do we know about the president's media diet and how he looks at Fox, I guess?
Well, we know that the president really watches a decent amount of television. Some former presidents would actually shun coverage of themselves. President Obama was kind of infamous for not watching, for claiming that he didn't watch cable news and only watching ESPN. This president is quite the opposite. He's very well connected to the media. He's constantly watching television. He's very well aware of his own coverage. He is known to record shows and return back and watch them later, even if they are, for example, morning shows. He's been known to talk about how great his DVR program is.
But this is more than just watching. It's almost symbiotic. Yeah. I mean, there you've got messages being sort of volleyed back and forth or burnished, Angelo, by Fox and the White House.
Yeah, that's right. And in particular, there's, you know, Fox and Friends and Trump have a special relationship, even more than just the regular Fox News and Trump. Donald Trump has repeatedly attributed his victory partially to his many years as having a regular weekly segment on Fox and Friends. On Fox and Friends prior to the election, and even in it's reflected very much even in his tweets. I mean, this year alone, since he's been president, he has promoted or tweeted or retweeted Fox and Friends specifically 36 times.
But this time aimed it at a major news institution and kind of looking to take it down. The president's fake news chant is out there all the time, and this time as well, saying with the idea of it as a threat to national security. Simon in Savannah, Georgia. Simon, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I'd like to say that President Trump's attack on the free press is obviously the first step on the road toward fascism. The first step in the fascist playbook is to delegitimize and control the media. And there's an article written by Umberto Eco, I think that's his name, entitled The 14 Points of Fascism, which would kind of give you a roadmap as to how it might unfold. Thanks, Tom.
Umberto Eco, novelist, Italian, might know of what he speaks. Angelo, is Simon's view too dire?
No, I don't think that it's too dire. I would be more, when I think about it, I try not to overwhelm it and just get very precise. One, and you alluded to this earlier, is that in terms of the authoritarian's playbook, you have to do two things simultaneously. One is you have to erode the capacity for the truth tellers and to sort of undermine the fact, and that is what the news media does. And then you simultaneously have to build up an alternative media apparatus. So you have to dismantle, but also build up something that's loyal and friendly. And both of those two things are certainly happening in tandem, while simultaneously eroding trust and legitimacy in these important facts and really arbiters of truth, these institutions. He is also simultaneously promoting a sycophantic and propagandistic media outlet, not just Fox and Friends, but also in the form of some other Fox News hosts like Sean Hannity, and then a few other sort of emerging right-wing media figures. And so I look at both sides of it, and that alone doesn't really bode well for autocracy.
Hadass, our time is short. Did the Times ever get its apology from Fox News, Hadass?
No, the Times did not get their apology. Fox and Friends, definitely, they updated their story, but they never apologized or necessarily issued a whole retraction.
And there we are, a situation with the White House and the American media, Fox and Friends, Fox News, and the New York Times in the summer of 2017. I want to thank both of you for being with us. Angelo Carusone, president of Media Matters for America, with us from London. Thank you, Angelo.
Thank you.
And Hadass Gold with Politico, covering media there. Hadass, thanks as always.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, a new politics and history podcast from WBUR.
Hey, thanks for sticking around for this preview from our show. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to Freak Out and Carry On wherever you get your podcasts.
Take a listen to this excerpt. Let's welcome our guest, Nick Ameli, director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. Welcome, Nico.
It's great to be here.
So, Nico, there's a widely accepted narrative that the media enabled Trump during his rise, during his campaign and his victory. But Also, haven't they been enabling him during those first 100 days? Tell me what the evidence shows as to how Trump has been signing up the media as his handmaiden.
So we've done five studies, all of 2015, 2016, and the first 100 days of Trump, looking at media coverage, mainstream major media coverage of Trump, everything from Fox News, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, et cetera. The truth is the media in during the campaign overwhelmingly gave Trump positive coverage. Mm. However, one of the reasons for that is that a lot of the stories were driven by polling. And the story was always that Trump was rising in the polls.
New CNN ORC polls very much about Donald Trump's huge lead as the choice of Republicans for the presidential nomination.
Despite all kind of conventional wisdom to the contrary, he was winning. And it won in the primaries. And so that favors Trump in a really overwhelmingly dramatic way.
However, how about the first 100 days?
In the first 100 days, the coverage is overwhelmingly negative. However, most of the time in the first 100 days, the only person that the media quotes on Trump is Trump. I think it's 6% of the time they quote a Democrat, 4% of the time a congressional Republican, almost no policy experts. The stories about Trump quote Trump. And so it's a very weird dynamic in that sense. It is overwhelmingly negative, but it's also all Trump all the time.
It's a reality show. They're going to the star.
Compared to the last three presidents, he dominates news coverage. So much more of the nightly newscast is about Trump than in the first 100 days than any prior president. It's really astonishing, almost to the exclusion of all other news.
I mean,
I'm talking about sports news and weather news. Like, he crushes it.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Is somebody mentioned sports news. I'll just mention this. Is that years ago, an ABC producer, I just thought for Ted Koppel, said, why do people watch sports on television? I said, well, I don't know. It's neatly lined. They're winners and losers. No. It's the only thing that occurs on television. It actually happens. Everything else is produced. Trump occurs on television. You can't take your eyes off of him.
In the 2 years of the presidential campaign, it doesn't matter which candidate or which issue. Pick any candidate, and Trump is quoted 2 to 3 times more in an article about that candidate than the candidate themselves.
Good God.
Trump is quoted more on Ted Cruz than Ted Cruz is. Trump is quoted more on Hillary Clinton than Hillary Clinton.
He had the best lines. Lying Ted, crooked Hillary, low energy Jeb. I mean, you know, you can't not credit a kind of twisted genius in managing that. He hung that around their neck in bully fashion. That's your name now.
I think a crucial question for the media is how they will cover the presidential campaign in 2020. Will they do anything differently?
Well, the problem is if you are either covering Trump or covering the resistance to Trump, he is still defining the narrative.
That's right.